Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Caffron Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Chipper.
Hey, is that a cup of tea you're drinking over there?
Of course.
Not good enough, I'm afraid.
I hate to be scolded first thing in the morning. That's like my worst thing, man. Take it easy. I'm drinking a cup of tea.
Not good enough. Our first topic of the day. Some may see a cup of tea as soothing, but chocolate.
One of those people who saw it as soothing until you scolded me for drinking it.
No, it is soothing, but it's not enough to lower one's blood pressure.
Well, you know why?
Why?
People yell at you when you drink it.
No, only me. So check this out. There's actually some seriousness behind our kidding around. It turns out that German researchers have figured out that foods rich in cocoa appear to reduce blood pressure, but drinking green and black tea may not. So while you feel like I'm not making you as angry while you're drinking your tea, I am. But if you had some cocoa, I might not upset you as much.
So it's tea and cocoa from now on. If I'm going to have my tea, I must have it with my cocoa.
That's kind of gross to have them all together. I think you should just have the cocoa. Here's the deal.
This was a little chocolate biscotti with my tea. Why not?
Well, that might work. But here in an article published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, which is published by the American Medical Association, there was a drop in blood pressure among participants in a study who consumed cocoa products for at least 2 weeks. And that drop was equivalent to the same as someone taking drugs commonly prescribed to control high blood pressure. So hold up a second. There was a control group, their blood pressure stayed high. The people who took the blood pressure drugs, their blood pressure dropped. And the people who were on the cocoa, their blood pressure dropped as well.
I love it. Finally we see something that really is good, that tastes great, and there's enough evidence here that says this can actually help you with your blood pressure.
Now, how does it work, you might ask?
I ask, how does it work, Francis?
Thanks for being the straight man, Mark. That's great. But both cocoa and tea contain polyphenols, and wine as well contains polyphenolic compounds. And these are a class of chemicals known to help prevent cardiovascular disease, just like most fruits and vegetables. So people with high blood pressure are often told to have a lot of fruits and vegetables. Well, cocoa has a different type than tea. It has a procyanid. Boy, am I getting to be a little bit like a geek here?
Yeah, like one.
A little geeky, sorry. But the cocoa is more active. The procyanids are more active in lowering your blood pressure, which can be expected to reduce the risks of strokes and heart attacks.
I think it's just because eating chocolate actually makes you feel good. Mm. So it reduces your blood pressure because you feel better.
I view chocolate as medicinal, but hold on a second. Don't start gobbling up the chocolate bars just now.
Right.
This is what that was written in the study, author of the study, Dirk Taubert of the University Hospital of Germany. Cologne, Germany. Dark chocolate treats and candies, they have high sugar very often. But there are many chocolate products out there that you can find in America that have high cocoa and don't necessarily have the high sugar.
Even now, there are more and more, even the mainstream brands, you're seeing people have a lot of cocoa, really high cocoa contents, and a lot less sugar added into them and a lot of less cream added into them. And obviously, these are the types of things we're talking about. If you're going to have your traditional, you know, Hershey's Kisses, that you may not get the same benefit that you're going to get from one of those super premium high cocoa products.
Well, and the other thing is, I like to use cocoa in my cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't use Dutch cocoa because that's alkaline processed cocoa, but there are some cocos that you can make, like Valrhona chocolate you can ask it your
really
retailer.
Awesome cocoa powder.
They make a cocoa powder. And, you know, in the wintertime, I like hot chocolate, but I really like hot cocoa. It's lighter to me, and it's a little more bitter, and I don't sweeten it as much. And you can use cocoa powder in your cooking, and it adds a bitter component, but you can use it in your food.
So what you're saying is I can have a chocolate martini and actually lower my blood pressure?
I don't know that I can say that. I think that I might get sued for that.
You are implying it, though, and I can infer it if I choose.
Well, it's my plan of action. I'm just not recommending it to anyone else. Chocolate martini, by the way, made with cocoa powder instead of chocolate or any of those silly chocolate liqueurs.
Mm.
Absolutely delicious.
Dessert. It's actually dessert.
We make them at the restaurant. It is dessert, but it's not too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's the funny thing about cooking with chocolate in food. In Latin American cuisine, we have the tradition of the mole sauce, which does not necessarily – a mole doesn't have to include cocoa, but most traditional Mexican moles include cocoa. Cocoa is not just for sweet chocolate. And so I remember the first time I had a chicken en mole, which is a chicken in a sauce that's based in cocoa.
It adds a sauce, right.
It adds a bitterness, and people call it a chocolate sauce, but it's really not chocolate, because we should tell people what the difference is, actually. Chocolate is basically, you take the cocoa bean has two ingredients in it. It's broken up into two ingredients, the cocoa powder and the cocoa butter. All right, and then to make chocolate candy, or chocolate couverture, as they call it, we take the cocoa powder and the cocoa butter from the cocoa bean. You add more cocoa butter, and you can add sugar and vanilla. And those are the four ingredients in basic chocolate. So it's very simple. The cocoa is just the bitter part and just the solid part without the creamy and rich part of the butter, and can be really magical in food and in cocktails, but you got to be very careful with how you use it. Have I educated you enough on the chocolate?
I'm done.
Shall we go on?
Please.
Okay. Another study that just came out, New York Magazine did a very interesting thing. They were looking at all the fast food restaurants are being criticized for how high in caloric content their food is. Charles Stewart Plotkin wanted to discover what the caloric content and the fat content, how good or bad for you the various tasting menus are for you at the high end in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was he went and got the tasting menu at Per Se and basically would eat half of it, take the other half, and put it in a Ziploc bag and stick it in his girlfriend's purse. Then took it to a laboratory.
I've actually seen people do that, but I think for different reasons.
And then he took it to a laboratory and had it analyzed. Well, the multi-course tasting menu at Per Se, the grand tasting menu, winds up at a total of a little less than four and a half Big Macs.
All right, but hold on a second. First of all, there's no French fries. Second of all, there's no Big Coke.
Right.
Third of all, most people don't have the 9-course Per Se tasting menu
every day
as one of their three meals.
Right.
Okay, that's not typically the way most Americans eat. You don't go to Per Se four times a week and say, bring me the 9-course tasting menu.
Well, I think the valid point that the Per Se tasting menu is little less than four and a quarter Big Macs. But the Big Mac and the big soda and the fries are more than a Big Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when you go for they call it the grand degustation menu for a reason, because it's an event. And even people, if you eat out at restaurants, and we have a lot of people who come to our restaurant that eat out of fancy restaurants all the time, you know, once in a blue moon, you go for the grand degustation menu. But if you're eating out at restaurants several days a week, you go for the petite menu, for an appetizer, an entree, and dessert.
Could I make one other point?
What?
The grand degustation menu takes about four and a half hours to eat.
Right.
The Big Mac, about 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to be clear about how we're consuming those calories.
And I think, Mark, you put it in the best perspective. With the problem is not that there exists a grand degustation menu that you can splurge on once in a while or even once a week. The problem is that if you eat Big Macs every day, you're going to be in a lot worse shape. And there we have us. Not that we're biased at all. We'll be back in just a moment talking about Italian wine with a very interesting producer of unusual varietals of Italian wine from his farm in Italy. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today, our guest is Jens Schmidt. Jens is a renowned expert on Italian wines and olive oil. He makes olive oil at his Monte Castelli estate in Tuscany, and he also represents some very unusual and very wonderful wines from Italy.
Jens, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, olive oil and wine sounds great, but Jens Schmidt doesn't sound Italian to me. How did you wind up in Tuscany?
Well, that's how I start most of my presentations on Italian wine and food. It is a very unlikely Italian name. It's a Scandinavian name from northern Germany. I'm born in the city of Bremen and ended up, though, as a student for studies in Italy and essentially never left.
And I can, having been to Italy and Tuscany in particular, I can completely understand that. But you wind up now, not only are you just sort of living there, but you started out making olive oil at the Monte Castelli estate, which you restored. It's a wonderful story. Can you tell us about Monte Castelli, you winding up there, and that turning into an olive oil production? That's something that you sort of backed into, isn't it?
Yeah, I originally came to Italy to continue my studies on architecture, and Italy is probably the prime location for that purpose. But my family, from my mother's side, they were always farmers, and being in Tuscany helped to help my income as a student with harvesting grapes and olives, and formed strong connections in the agricultural community, and that is the element that's eventually survived in my professional career.
And tell us about the Monte Castelli estate.
After about 12 years living in Italy, I purchased the hilltop, a ruin, a pile of stones, as my wife calls it, and we set out to restore it together, which took us another 13 years, and finally everything was together, and surrounding the pile of stones, there was an old abandoned olive grove, which we cleared out and repruned, refertilized, reworked, and added thereafter another 1,300 trees to it to really beef it up to a full-size agricultural production.
You know, it's amazing, and I've heard similar stories before of people finding, you know, age-old olive groves that had kind of been neglected and either grown over by other products, or, you know, other trees and shrubbery and things like that, that after the other things were cleared away, the olive
orchards
that survived produced some spectacular olive oils. Is that the case with Monte Castelli?
Yeah, we tried very hard. It's 1,500 trees may sound like a lot, but it's still compared to the Puglian or Sicilian or Spanish olive grove. It's a fairly small operation. So being at a very high altitude location, our only choice was really going for the best. And I was strongly encouraged by friends around the corner running restaurants. One of them, Gaetano, a two-star Michelin restaurant, he loved what we were doing. He liked the olive oil. And so every year we tried to do it a little better. It started obviously in the grove and bring it back together with the organic farming techniques.
How long did it take you to get olives from that grove?
The old grove produced pretty much instantly, but it was initially it was a bitter, an unpleasant kind of oil. We needed to work the groves, reprune them, balance the trees. After 3 years, we started really to produce a high-quality olive oil. Considered then purchasing a in-house olive mill where we have further control of speed and of the extraction process of the oil. And I think today, after 13 years of working at it, we're pretty happy with what we're producing.
Now, your olive oil is considered some of the best and one of the most unique olive oils in all of Italy. Most people in Italy and elsewhere around the world, when you produce when you bring in your olives, you then need to bring them to a cooperative mill to have them crushed by someone else, by a cooperative. And that entails some things that may not be the best for the olive oil. What kind of things can you overcome by having your own mill right on site that maybe were problematic for you when you had to have someone else grind your olives into olive oil?
Well, the main issue is timing. Olives are fresh fruits, just the same as apples and bananas are. So if you pick them off the tree, from the minute you take them off, they start to oxidize, and eventually a process of decay and fermentation sets in. So the objective in the process of the harvest is to shorten that time as much as possible. If you have to take your olives to a local cooperative, and they may be equipped with the best technology available, but still that means that you have to store them after the day of harvest in-house, then load them the next morning onto a truck in cases or sacks and cart them over to the mill, which often is like a 30-45 minute drive, stand in line until it's your turn, then you dump the olives in a machinery that processes at high speed for many months, many olives.
I think that people may not realize that olives are produce like any produce because necessarily olive oil has a longer shelf life than other produce that we might have. I think people neglect to realize that olives themselves still
are fresh fruit.
Yes.
Yes, they absolutely are. And because they often appear in a bottle, they are associated with either wine or vinegar, which are both fermented products. Olive oil is not. It's a fresh food product. And the difficulty, the biggest difficulty is to present it to our clients as fresh as possible right off the tree.
Well, and I think there are some very interesting and striking ways in which you meld technology and tradition that make a pretty unique product that I want to talk about in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450, the time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis. We're talking with Jens Schmidt, who's from Monte Castelli, which is a wine importer and also a maker of Primo Olio, one of the best olive oils in Italy. And we're on the show not just because it's the best, because of the way it's made is unique. Now, we were talking, Jens, before the break about how the olive oil that you make, or the olive oil that most people make, you know, has to go to the co-op and it has to be moved around a lot and has to wait online. You press your olive oil within what? How quickly?
Oh, within 3 hours, I would say. So our objective. If I send the harvesters out in the morning, I basically go into the mill and start up the process, clean up the machinery, get it ready for the delivery of the first olives that arrive probably around 11.
So where a lot of olives that go to the other olives that go to the co-op may take as much as 2 days, 48 hours.
Yes,
to be
I would
pressed.
Say by Appellation regulations, if you make a DOP oil, so an Appellation olive oil, you are supposed to bring it to the olive mill within 48 hours. In our process, we can shorten that significantly, and I'd say the average is 3 hours.
Well, and you know, the other interesting thing in reading about your olive oils that I found fascinating that I didn't realize was if you're using the cooperative mill, they don't, like, start it up for you. You get scheduled for your time at the mill, and you harvest your olives based on, if you're going to the cooperative mill, based on when your appointment is, not on when your olives are ready.
Correct.
When you have your own mill, just like, you know, when you read about wine, they always talk about when the grapes were harvested. We waited until this exact moment. We thought that this was exactly the right time to harvest. You do this with olive oil, correct?
Yes, we do this with olive oil, and we are at full liberty to really employ all our knowledge on how to produce it. So there was a lot of talk recently in olive oil production about taking out the pids or milling the pid or cutting it up with knives and then milling it or malaxing the olive paste without oxygen or with a little bit of oxygen, so we can make all these choices now on our own in order to monitor and give continuity in terms of quality performance of oil.
Jens, can you do me a favor? We don't have enough time to talk about it in this segment of the show, but can you do me a favor? When we come back from the news, will you talk to us a little bit about the different kinds of olive oil and how they're different?
And when we come back, we'll be talking more with Jens Schmidt about olive oil, and we're also going to turn the topic to wine, because some of the most exciting and interesting wines you're going to find coming out of Italy today are through Monte Castelli Imports. Jens is going to be at Stage Left to do a wine dinner on the 12th of June. If you want to find out more about him or more about the dinner, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com. For the dinner, go to stageleft.com or give us a call and make a reservation and come meet Jens when he's here in America. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com and download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Jens Schmidt, who has Monte Castelli Imports and Monte Castelli Olive Oil from Tuscany. We were talking before the news about olive oil, about the olive oil that you make in your Monte Castelli estate, which we can try if you come to the wine dinner. You're going to be coming on the 12th, right, to do a dinner with us?
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You get to meet some of our folks, and they're really wine-interested people, and we'll have a glass of wine and some olive oil together.
So, Jens, can you give us some of the basic definitions of what different olive oils are and the difference between an extra virgin and a virgin and all of those different things we see on our shelves?
Well, the terms of olive oil that we're used to deal with are terms that were invented now over 20, 30 years ago and that serviced mostly a industrial categorizing right. of olive oils. Olive oil extra virgin needed to be only made from vegetable source of less than 1% of acidity. So it could actually derive from non-olive oil or olive-based oils, for example, rape or corn oils were all allowed to be blended into olive oil. Therefore, recently appellations have been formed both here in the U.S. and California, and in Europe. In Europe, they're called DOPs. Here in America, it's the California Olive Oil Council overseeing regulations to actually produce olive oil based only on olives. A good oil should have less than 0.3% of acidity. Today, rules for the DOP still allow for more. We are looking to produce olive oil at Monte Castelli. If we do everything correct and we don't even have a particularly good vintage, that rarely exceeds 0.15%.
But if we're looking at the bottle, what can we look for delineations of quality besides a name?
That is a difficult one still. Yes. The California Olive Oil Council has developed a little brand symbol that sometimes you can find at the neck of the bottle. The Italian or European appellations are distinct by a DOP writing on the front label.
What does DOP stand for?
Denominazione Origine Protetta. So it's a protected origin or original description that monitors whether these acreage of olive growth actually exist, what varieties they are planted to, whether those varieties are typical for the area.
So looking for some of these things on the label, I think, are more delineation of quality than necessarily virgin, extra virgin, those types of things, which can be on the labels of mass-produced olive oils, which can have other things blended into them.
Absolutely, that's correct. And the main thing that I would suggest to look for at the bottle is not the date until which the oil is considered to be good by, but the date of the harvest. If a producer lists the date of the harvest, then this is an honest agricultural product that makes reference to a real agricultural event and not to an industrial bottling date.
So there you have it, born on dating. Now, Jens, let's turn our attention to wine. It's funny, I was unfamiliar with, I'm ashamed to admit, your company until about 2 weeks before, the New York Times wrote an article. Our friend Eric Asimov, who's been on the show many times, wrote an article about a particular almost lost variety of grapes in Italy called Asperino di Aversa. Mm-hmm. And 2 days prior to that article coming out, a woman came in representing your portfolio and told me the story and poured the wine, and I ordered it. And I got it in the day before the New York Times article came out, and I thought, I'm a genius!
Very good.
Actually, it's great because, you know, when an article like that comes out in the Times, we get several people who come in, hey, you know, I'd love to try an Asperino. And and you're, oh, of course I have one. And yes, it's right here.
And like Tigger, you're the only one. Let's talk about that particular wine, which I find fascinating and indicative of the other sorts of traditions and wines that your portfolio specializes in and tries to keep alive.
Yeah, with my interest in agriculture, when I started to taste wine with some important enologists in Italy, immediately focused on indigenous varieties. And the homeland to indigenous varieties in Italy must be the area around the city of Naples, Campania. And the city of Aversa is not far from there, just about 20 kilometers north of Naples. And the variety Asprigno is a unique story. Was actually developed by the Bourbon Kings. They were looking forward to continue drinking their sparkling wines, otherwise produced in the French territory.
The Bourbon Kings, they made some great music back in the late 80s, didn't they?
No, that was a different... That was a different
sorry.
So, go ahead.
And we were here, though, several climate zones further south than in France, and in order to make sparkling wine, you need a good base acidity. And you wouldn't be able to achieve this in the hot suns of Naples. So what they did is they, at the time, could obviously not intervene in the cellar with cooling methods or other techniques. They actually said, no, we have to intervene here in viticulture, and they planted grapevines between poplar trees and had them grow up to 20 yards of height, and thus dispersing the energy of the grapevine, were able to achieve that the grape clusters received less energy, develop less fast, and build up less sugars, and maintain more acidity. So they actually had, with a very unique growing condition, achieved a very similar maturity pattern.
What they did is they wanted grapes with higher acidity, but there's so much sun and so much energy down in the south.
Very difficult to do.
That, you know, the grapes use that energy and make sugar, so the acidity drops off. And so what they did was they had to use up some of the energy of those vines. And so what they did was they trained the vines to climb up the trees.
That's
and
correct.
So these grapevines are trellised into the trees.
Yes.
And so you have to harvest these grapes on a ladder.
Yes,
which is fascinating. I don't know any place in the world.
As if you were picking
oranges,
you're up picking grapes.
They're special pickers that know how to walk with these ladders from grapevine to grapevine, because it would be obviously very bothersome to always climb down 20 yards on a ladder and then move the ladder and climb back up. So they're special harvesters that can pick these grapes.
Now, how does it work? How do you walk on a ladder?
I think it is just imagine it's like a circus balancing act.
Yeah, I would imagine that insurance is relatively hard to get for something like that.
Workman's comp claims very high in this particular profession.
Now, one of the things I think that, you know, Mark and I look for things like this, you know, traditional methods of production and people's traditions from all over the world, because I think one of the things that we're trying to fight against, and many people are trying to fight against, is losing these old traditions, which are sort of marginally economically viable, maybe. But you're on sort of a mission to preserve these sorts of traditions, aren't you?
Yes, we started out to offer our service not only as importers or selectors, but also a little bit as agriculture consultants to young entities, young wineries that formed in Italy with the mission to preserve those varieties. Italy has about 2,000 presumed indigenous varieties, 400 already registered, meaning via DNA fingerprinting or university research established independent varieties. And we, starting in 98, invested all our energies into developing this. When we started it, nobody wanted to hear about indigenous varieties. Now we start to have people like Eric Osimov picking up these ideas and starting to write about them, and we are now also seeing some good feedback on our work here in the United States.
You know, it's funny, when you walked into our place, Mark and I, the people came in, they're like, you know, not a lot of people have heard of these, and they're, you know, very, you know, you have to explain them to people, and I thought, wow, that's exactly what I've been doing for 15 years. I have half of your portfolio on my wine list. And, you know, It's interesting to me, and I think it's the best thing, and one of the best things that wine can be put to is preserving tradition. How do you help these folks? I mean, it strikes me that in many of these regions where it's difficult to continue on with a tradition, how does the next generation How do we find the next generation of pickers to stay in Aversa and pick the Aspirino di Aversa?
Well, I think probably our help is twofold. One part that really makes it easy is that we purchase these wines, import them. Therefore, we make, help them make it financially viable. The second part is what we work very hard on is not substituting their enologists or their winemaker, their viticulturists, but helping them to avoid errors. Small entities that set out in order to preserve variety, like Uva di Troia or Palagrello, they have no comparative data, so they cannot step out and say, I know that I have to use this trellising method. I have to use this pruning technique. I have to use this density model. So a lot of choices out there before working with a variety that we have basically no knowledge on can be wrong. We help them by connecting them to other young and indigenous variety operations to avoid making errors. So we're trying to shorten their time for them to meet success.
Yeah, for some of these things, it's almost like planting a brand new grape. You got to learn all about the planting some of these other grapes.
Completely forgotten. They were considered, because they are late ripening or low yielding varieties, they were considered financially not economical, and their father's generation, their grandfather's generation, ripped them out. They were not tended to any longer.
We're going to have to take a quick break, Jens. We're going to leave it there for just a moment, but we'll be back talking more with Jens Schmidt from Monte Castelli Imports about his Tuscan wines. You can meet Jens Schmidt and come and hang out with us and have some wine and olive oil and food on June the 12th, where he'll be coming to Stage Left to do a dinner. Give us a call. Look us up at stageleft.com under events, and you can find out the details and even make a reservation online. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1146.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on Nine is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Jens Schmidt from Monte Castelli in Tuscany. He's a producer of olive oil and an importer of very unusual wines from Italy. You can meet him on the 12th of June at Stage Left Restaurant, where we're going to have him come down and pour some of his wines. We were talking before about preserving traditional varieties of wines, and I think one of the things that, your company does and promotes and works with producers who do, are it's a very interesting combination of preserving traditions while utilizing modern methods of cleanliness and using technology to sort of safeguard these traditions rather than using technology to replace these traditions. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, technology is not something that we look upon as bad. We don't want to turn the wheel back on science, but we want to use winemaking, or in my case also in the olive oil production, not as a theory, but leave plenty of room for the intuitive, for the more immediate and decision-making process that always happens in agriculture. So technology is great. It's a tool for, as you said, cleanliness, to emphasize the fruit and the character of each product, helping it to, you know, by temperature control or by cleanliness in the cellar, to get even a greater character that probably would have been achievable during the times of the Romans. But that doesn't mean that we want to ignore the great knowledge the Romans had on winemaking. So we'd rather integrate both of these ideas into one more complex vision.
I think we can use technology to help us better understand what's happening during the process and how we can affect those things rather than trying to totally manipulate the process.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Jens, but I want to ask you about your view or your producer's view on organic agriculture, biodynamic agriculture. A lot of the producers who come on this show, the producers we buy from, practice these two things, or at least partially practice some of these two views of agriculture. Where does Monte Castelli come down on this issue?
It's pretty simple. Italian farmers always have remembered that the moon has an influence on farming. There are certain times where you can plant, certain times when you can seed, there are certain times to harvest. And even in the cellar, you have the wine in the barrel overflow with the moon phases, or you have to add in juice when all of a sudden miraculously it starts to miss. This is nothing in question. We emphasize, actually, biodynamics and organic farming methods because working with indigenous varieties, we feel as if they're almost a matrix inscribed into each of these varieties to their location that they are always have been grown in. So they actually can anticipate and survive with, you know, an easy early frost that comes in or a hot summer. These varieties have grown there for over 2,000 years. They remember their territory.
All right, so let me ask you another question that I hadn't anticipated asking you, but there is something that my friends and I debate all the time, and I believe it exists. And it's called sympathy with the vines. And that's where you may be drinking a bottle of wine from Bendole, from Tuscany, from wherever. And if there's a major event happening in the life cycle of the vines, like if the vines are shutting down for the winter or if there's a bloom going on, you may, even if you're thousands of miles away, drinking a bottle of wine from that vineyard from another year, experience that the wine is a little different at certain times of the year. There might be a little petiance that appears, a little bubbling, a feeling of bubbling that appears, or the acidity might be different based on what's going on in the vineyard. Some people say that really happens. They call it the bottle of wine having sympathy with the vines back home. Some people say it's a bunch of hocus-pocus nonsense. Francis, you've been drinking too much. What do you think?
I think there's no question that this exists. This is wine is alive. Wine is speaking to us all the time and changes. If it wouldn't, then, you know, we would be looking only at an industrial beverage, which the wine that I conceive it as definitely is not.
Okay, we're going to be friends now, Jens. That's great. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I look forward to seeing you on June 12th when you'll be doing a dinner at our restaurant. Hopefully some of our listeners can come, and they can find out about that by going to stageleft.com and clicking on events. Thanks, Jens.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Jens.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. Love talking with Jens Schmidt of Monte Castelli Imports. Love that he validated my opinion on sympathy with the vines.
You know, how Jens' company, Jens, it's a very small company at this point still, and a lot of hand selling, a lot of going to from place to place to place, from person to person to person, and kind of preaching the religion. It's getting somebody to try an Aspirino and put it on their list before the Asimov article. You got to put your face in front of people, and you got to talk to people and say, you know what, here it is. Here's what I got, and here's why it's special.
Because people do come in and say, hey, do you have a Chianti? Nobody comes in and says, hey, do you have an Aspirino di Aversa?
Unless Asimov wrote about it today.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
That's when that
and
happened.
And forgotten about it by the final week.
But, you know, he was talking about a phenomenon, and we spoke about it at the very end of the last segment called Sympathy with the Vines.
I love it, yeah.
And that's a real thing, and I want some of the people who come in, and Francis and I will joke about stuff like that and kind of the voodoo of wines, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We'll joke about, you know, things like sympathy with the vines, but this is a real thing, and actually what happens during periods of time with...
When there's a major event happening at the vineyard, like bud break or the first frost...
These wines will change. They'll go through
a funky period,
an awkward period. And there are a couple of wines that I can think of that we've had over the years that had that. Etude Pinot Noir is a wine like that. Pinot Noir seems to be the one. We had another wine from Oregon called Beaufrère.
We've had some Rieslings that do this.
Absolutely.
The more organically produced the wine, the less intervention in the wine, the more mm-hmm. likely this is to happen. And what we're saying is, I'm not talking about the wine of the vineyard. I'm talking about wines in our cellar that are 5 years old.
That we've had in our cellar for 5 years.
And, you know, Mark and I taste these wines again and again and again. We'll get five or six cases in of something. So I've tasted the wine 200 times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometime in November, I'll be like, hey, you know, something's weird about this wine. And then the next November, it will happen again for like 2 or 3 days. And if you call the vineyard and say, hey, what's going on at your vineyard?
Right, they'll tell you first frost or it's bud break or some phenomenon that's happening right at that moment. It's really a little creepy.
Just goes to show you there's more to it than even we understand. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.